Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam will be talking with David King, Chief Executive Officer and President of LabCorp, about science and laboratory medicine.
You know, Christy, this is a conversation I've been really looking forward to for a long time because there's been a revolution in laboratory medicine, and it's so integral to our lives and our patients' lives. And to be able to have a conversation with one of the leading companies and a leader in this region about this issue that affects all of us nationally, really critically important.
It sure is. But first, we have some research that matters. It's also important. We're going to talk about grown-ups and smartphones at mealtimes.
That's a conversation.
Uh-huh.
About certain types of electrical devices maybe zapping away migraines. What do you think?
And about a study showing raw milk may not help people with lactose intolerance.
And then, you know, we've had a lot of research, Christy, about animal protein versus vegetable-based protein, and this is a study that wants to challenge it just a little bit. We'll see what we think.
All right, let's talk about the smartphone.
You got one?
I've got one.
How yes. smart is it?
Well, it's pretty darn smart, and it's really easy to be attached to it. And, you know, this was a study that looked and was published in Pediatrics.
Great journal.
Where researchers watched at mealtime 55 caregivers with young children who were at fast food restaurants in the Boston area to see, like, how many of them were using their smartphone during the meal, what was happening with the conversation with the children, or lack thereof, and the behavior of the children.
So out of these 55 observed caregivers, 73% used their smartphones at some point during the meal, and 30% used them almost continuously throughout the meal, only briefly putting it down. Made me think, Christy, what do I do? What's it like there? Because we're doctors. We get phone calls. We have all kinds of things going on. I know that I don't like using my phone during the meal, and I talk with my family that this is a time in which we don't particularly answer the phone, but we got to consciously put our phones away.
Right, and stop checking email or responding to texts. I mean, there are lots of things going on with our smartphones. We know that those interpersonal interactions during mealtimes are really beneficial to children's health and to their development, and they need attention. And they found in the study that made me sad was that in the cases where the parent was diverted to the phone, the child kept trying to make conversation, and the parent would respond with maybe an inappropriate answer, the child might act out to try to, like, step it up to try to get the parent's attention. And that part made me sad and definitely makes me want to go home and revisit a conversation with my husband to make sure we are not even bringing it to the
okay,
table.
Okay, well, let's raise our right hands. All our listeners out there, Christy, right hand.
I pledge
that I will try not to be answering and being on my phone during a large part, if not most, of my meals with my family.
That is a wonderful thing. I've got my hand up right now, too. We're going to do better.
Okay, let's talk about our next research that matters, which is about migraine headaches. And I don't have them a lot, but I have them occasionally. I understand this is a real big problem.
It is. They're hard to treat. And a lot of the medicines that are used for prevention have a lot of side effects. And even the medicines for treatment have side effects. So this is a study, and now it's an FDA-approved device. It's called Cephali, is the trade name, that is placed on the forehead along with a small electrode and delivers some electrical stimulation to the brain. And this article is about the study showing that it does make some benefit.
This was published in the journal Neurology, and it was 67 people from Belgium who had about 4 migraines a month, and they used this electrical stimulation to the nerves of the brain 20 minutes a day for 3 months, and then they compared this to a treatment that was kind of a sham electrical stimulation. They didn't expect it to have any effect, and they looked to see if it was improved outcomes, which they found.
I know, pretty impressive. I mean, didn't fix it for everyone, but about 38% of patients who received the stimulation had at least a half or 50% reduction in their frequency of migraine days compared with 12% for the people who wore these sham glasses where it wasn't real stimulation. So, I mean, it did have a benefit about the same as the medications, but without side effects in these
studies. Yeah, they said there were no side effects, and I guess—
hard to believe.
It's hard to believe. There's no free ride, and there were only 67 patients. So I do have a little bit of a concern. Of course, we're also talking about medications that have side effects. I'm also concerned about the cost of this. And so there, I think there's more reason to at least look into this further, but I'm not recommending it quite yet.
Agreed. Well, let's talk about whether or not we recommend raw milk.
Gross. I don't think it's gross. I don't drink raw milk. But part of it is because I've been conditioned by lots of people to say raw milk, non-pasteurized milk, isn't safe. But I know a lot of people do. So I respect that. But this study looks at, is this actually a good treatment? Would it help people who have lactose, they can't digest the enzymes from regular pasteurized milk?
Yeah. So, I mean, the American Academy of Pediatrics advises clearly that people not drink raw milk due to the bacterial risk in the raw milk. But a lot of people do it for lactose intolerance. So this study came out in the Annals of Family Medicine. It was a pilot study looking at just 16 people who had identified themselves as lactose intolerant, having symptoms that were moderate to severe, to see if there was a benefit with raw milk.
And in the pilot study with 16 people who had all said that they were lactose intolerant and said they had moderate to severe symptoms, did not show a benefit of the raw milk. And so I think this at least begins to answer.
Just
it doesn't do it
more
conclusively, but it would be consistent with the position of the American Academy of Pediatrics that they're not recommending it for pregnant women and children.
All right. So let's go to our last one. And this is about diets and animal protein potentially helping to prevent functional decline in elderly individuals. And what that means is, like, you know, their ability to think through and understand what's going on and be able to do their activities of daily living, those sorts of function as people age.
And this was actually in the Journal of the American Geriatric Society, which is a really important journal. And this was took place in Japan, and they did an analysis of just over 1,000 individuals who were an average age of about 67 at the start of the study, and then they followed them up 7 years later, and they looked at different groups according to their total levels of intake of animal and plant proteins.
And what they found were that the men in the highest quartile of animal protein intake had a 39% decreased chance of experiencing higher level functional decline than those people who ate the least amount of animal protein.
And they didn't find this association in women, and they didn't find it in association with plant protein intake and higher levels and functional decline. So for me, Christy, the take home is interesting, but it's not a game changer.
Well, and you don't eat animal meat, right?
I don't, but I think the more important question is here is there's lots of other reasons in all the research with the Framingham and other, the Mediterranean mm-hmm. diet, and other elements that says that we should be moving more towards vegetable-based proteins in terms of lowering
heart disease risk.
There is, we talked about in last week's show about this importance of building muscle mass as you get older and that may increase. And so it may not be, there may be other ways of doing muscle mass than simply adding back in the animal protein. Certainly for a lot of people who are doing animal protein who are nice and thin and fit, this is probably reassuring, but I don't think I we could recommend this. And this study didn't show this. This wasn't a clinical trial.
And we also don't know where the people who are eating more meat and animal proteins, maybe they were also working out more and lifting weights and doing those things. So there are other factors that might be a part of this.
We want to pick and choose all the best from all the studies.
That's right.
Interesting research. We wanted to bring it for to our listeners. Well, that'll conclude our Research That Matters, Christy. We're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with David King, Chief Executive Officer and President of LabCorp, about science and laboratory medicine. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We'll be right back. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Mr. David King, Chief Executive Officer and President of LabCorp, about science and laboratory medicine. A really important conversation, and we're so glad that you're here with us today, Dave.
Thank you for having me, Adam.
We're glad you're with us, but we'd love to give a little framework for our listeners of what is LabCorp. It seems obvious to us as providers, but maybe people in the public don't know about LabCorp and its role. And then how did you become involved in it?
LabCorp is the second largest clinical laboratory in the United States and probably in the world. We have about 34,000 employees. We do business in all 50 states and in over 40 countries. And what we do is everything from the most routine type of laboratory testing. So you go to your doctor and the doctor orders a lipid panel, a CBC to test your blood count, to the most sophisticated and complex types of genetic and genomic testing, where we look for reproductive genetics, any mutations that might be passed on from a parent to a child, explanations for early development, childhood development of disease. So we offer over 4,400 different laboratory tests, and as part of that broad menu, we can provide the most complete range of services to support physicians in diagnosing, treating, and looking at the progression of disease. I got involved in LabCorp back in 1995. I was a lawyer practicing law in Baltimore, Maryland, and I was hired by the company to work on a fairly sizable issue that they needed to get resolved. We got it resolved. I joined the company in 2001 as general counsel, and I became the CEO in 2007.
Wow.
Well, it's, I guess it answers the question, are CEOs born or are they made? And I guess it's a little bit of a combination of both. But, you know, when I think back to the start of our careers as family doctors, we've grown up around this impressive need or this belief that laboratory medicine is essential to diagnosis. Has it always been like that? When did that become or really such an integral part of all of medicine?
I think if you really wanted to examine the history of when laboratory medicine became so critical, there have been two or three major developments. The first one, believe it or not, is the Pap smear. So the Pap smear, which is a very simple routine laboratory test, it's performed, I'm going to say, probably 100 million times a year, really changed the course of cervical cancer because it became a very straightforward test. In the old days, you put cells on a slide and a pathologist looked at them through a microscope. Today, it's highly computerized and the computers actually look at the slide and determine if there are abnormal cells that need to be reviewed by a pathologist. But the Pap smear really revolutionized the practice of medicine for women's health. The other was the development of tests as simple as the complete blood count. So the ability to look at the white blood cell count and see if a patient had an infection. The ability to look at the cells and see if there were to see if the patient had meningitis with a laboratory diagnostic instead of, you know, much more complex and time-consuming testing. These were things that began to revolutionize medicine in the 40s and 50s, and that seems like a short time ago, but it's really a long time ago. And as you and Christy know, in the arc of the much more complex practice of medicine that we have today versus what it was 50 and 60 years ago.
And so LabCorp has evolved into this giant industry. And I understand that across the nation, you are handling tests, running these tests, providing results to providers and patients. Do you also have a segment that's doing research within your company to develop new technologies? Or what is your relationship with universities and other research industries?
So we have a very robust new test development process. Now, we are not a research company. So many of the things that we do are collaborations with academic medical centers. We do licensing. We do sponsored research where we fund research on a particular test that may be of interest or a particular area of research that may be of interest. We partner with private companies to develop diagnostic testing. But again, just to give you an example, last year we introduced, in 2013, we introduced 152 new tests to our menu. And that's a combination of new technology for running tests that we have run before but now can run more efficiently or more reliably. It's bringing tests in that we were previously sending out. And it's also the continued development of more specific and sensitive tests, in other words, higher reliability tests for things like quantitation of viral loads in HIV, hepatitis C, and other infectious diseases that, again, help the physician, the provider, treat the disease most effectively with the available toolkit, including drug therapy.
So if we think about, and again, it's something that I think I may even take for granted, this ability to diagnose things laboratory-wise today that certainly when I started my medical training we couldn't do, or at least I don't think we did, like diagnosing hemochromatosis, which is this important iron overload that we can prevent a lot of the complications about. Are there tests today or of these 152 or within the last 2 or 3 years that are relatively new that are really transformative? If we think about the pharmaceutical industry, the drugs that are the copy drugs, but then the drugs that really are a leap forward. What are some more recent leap forward sorts of diagnostic tests we can do?
I think that, for example, you think about hepatitis C. And so the CDC came out with a recommendation a couple of years ago that all baby boomers should be screened for hepatitis C because of the high risk of infection, whether it was blood transfusion, whether it was needles, whether it was tattoos, whether it was drugs. Well, the hepatitis C screen is a quite simple test, but from that hepatitis C screen, we can run if the test comes back positive, we can run a viral load to see the degree of infection. We can genotype the hepatitis C to see which exact strain of the virus it is, which indicates how it's going to respond to a particular drug. There are multiple examples. HPV, for example, so is a very important
human papillomavirus.
Human papillomavirus
causes cervical cancer, and
that's right. So the ability to test for human papillomavirus and now to be able again to genotype the virus and say, is this one that is likely to progress to cervical cancer? Is it likely to be transient and abate? The thing that has really been game changing is the continued refinement of our test menu and also putting these tests in combinations that are more readily accessible and understandable to physicians. So, for example, thyroid testing. You know, thyroid abnormalities are underdiagnosed in the United States, and they're underdiagnosed because because thyroid abnormality mimics the symptoms of so many other types of disease. You're tired, you're not tired, you're cold, you're hot, you're hyperactive, you're exhausted all the time. But with the thyroid cascade, which is a way of reorganizing the thyroid tests, the physician is able to order one test, and then the laboratory, based on the result of that test, is able to perform a sequence of tests that help the physician diagnose, does the patient have thyroid disease? Is it overactive, underactive thyroid? And, you know, what are appropriate treatment options?
You know, this whole question of testing and the transformation, I know we're going to want to talk about the individualized kind of testing, people wanting to know what are my risk of diseases and this belief that we can do laboratory testing to diagnose everything. But I just wonder if you can just give us a framework. Is this the next game changer? Are we there yet in terms of understanding your own individual risk of disease and being able to diagnose your risk at early ages?
I think the answer is in a small number of cases, yes, and in most cases, no. So we can do a lot of very broad interrogation of the human genome, and about 95%, if not 99% of what comes back, we don't know whether it is causative or associative with disease.
Well, we certainly want to continue this conversation and hope to talk more about some genetic testing and direct-to-consumer testing that's out there. But we do need to take a short break. When we come back, we will continue talking with our guest, David King, Chief Executive Officer and President of LabCorp, about science and laboratory medicine. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with David King, Chief Executive Officer and President of LabCorp, about science and laboratory medicine. And Dave, you were talking with us before the break about many of the advances in genetic testing. And one of the things we haven't had a chance to touch on are some of these spin-off lab companies where you can send a kit to somebody's house and they can test their blood for whatever things they want to test. Or where we have home monitoring kits where people can check their INR if they're on a blood thinner, check how thin their blood are, or check their diabetes testing, and all these potential things that people, that the patients can have more control over. And I'm curious what LabCorp is doing in that arena and sort of what your thoughts are about the future.
Well, Christy, I think one of the certainties of the evolution of our healthcare system is that there's going to be more responsibility on the patient to be engaged in their health. And what we've seen in the last couple of years is more financial responsibility where the patient is paying more and more out of pocket. But I think there's an increasing need for patient engagement. Having said that, you know, one of the concerns is the reliability of testing that is performed in the home, and the reliability generally of point of care testing has always been difficult to ascertain. So the FDA has very low regulatory burdens on direct to consumer testing for things like pregnancy tests and what they call wave testing. There's a higher burden on things like genetic testing. I think this is going to be an area that is rapidly evolving. So, for example, diabetics regularly check their insulin at home by finger stick. For most people, that works fine. For some people, it obviously creates issues because when they get a wild variation in their glucose, you know, what are they supposed to do? Mm-hmm. But I think we're going to see evolution here. The technology is going to get better. The importance of educating the patient is going to become even more critical. Speaking to two physicians and family practitioners, the importance of integrating the patient into the care continuum besides the physician and the office staff and the payer will also increase.
You know, when I think about laboratory medicine, the first word that comes to mind isn't always about ethical concerns. Not like that's not important, but it's not what I would think about. But when I think about clinical medicine and we give laboratory diagnoses to patients all the time, you know, an HIV test and the power of what that laboratory test, what are the ethical issues as a CEO of a major company? You must face certain ethical questions and dilemmas on a regular basis, including, you know, that a lot of what you do generates a lot of fear in people who receive it. How do you deal with these things and what do you do?
So we constantly have compliance issues, what's legal and what's not legal. And we have a compliance department and a staff of lawyers who deal with all of the ethical things surrounding how do we get business, how do we interact with physicians, what's appropriate, how do we interact directly with patients. I think probably the most challenging ethical issue, and it's only going to get more challenging, is when we perform a lot of the a lot of genetic testing, we perform more testing than the doctor orders. We don't charge for it, but if the doctor orders 32 markers of cystic fibrosis and we're performing a 90-marker test, there's going to be 58 markers that are looked at, yet the doctor hasn't ordered that test, hasn't requested it for the patient. So what do we do if we see an abnormality in marker number 90, which is not known to be associated with disease, highly unusual? This is where the ethics are going to get more and more complicated because we're going to be looking at the human genome. We're going to be sequencing genes. We're going to be seeing many, many mutations. And again, not all well understood, not all that we have the answer, is this causative of disease or not, and not necessarily something the doctor asked us to look at, because that's the way that the instrumentation runs the test. And I think there needs to be some hard work done in the question, how do you report that back to physicians and what do you tell patients?
Sounds like a Law and Order episode ready for prime time,
yes.
but in prime time.
Well, also, there are a number of ethical issues around physician ordering tests that aren't maybe appropriate. So there's a huge fad out there to get all these hormone tests done and get all these things that can be tested for. But aren't necessarily medically appropriate, at least by current science or evidence-based practice. And I guess you're not as challenged with that. The doctor orders it, you can run it, and you can do it. But I wonder what your thoughts are about sort of the movement of more testing is better from a patient perspective.
And I think the evidence would suggest that lab testing is both overutilized and underutilized at the same time, Christy. And what I mean by that is some tests are ordered too frequently, and that may be because of defensive medicine, or it may be because the physician went to medical school 30 years ago and is still ordering what he or she learned to order 30 years ago. On the other hand, some tests are ordered far too infrequently because they're not well known in the community, they haven't had sufficient uptake. And again, just to go back to some things we've talked about already in this time together, hepatitis C screening was vastly underutilized. There are more people in the United States infected with hepatitis C mm-hmm. than there are with HIV. Hepatitis C screening was vastly underutilized, and it's silent, so it's rarely symptomatic. But the people who do not have transient hepatitis C infection are going to progress to liver disease and, you know, very, very severe consequences. So the answer is
to help get the word out on things like that, or through your partnership with universities and the public health sector, trying to get the word out about some of these underutilized tests, particularly with hepatitis C.
And hepatitis C, we pressed for a long time to increase the scope of screening, and the CDC ultimately agreed with mm-hmm. us and put the recommendation out, and then the testing picked up. So, nobody would... I think like any service in healthcare, you would be naive to argue that there aren't some things that are done too often. But where I think we should also be focusing on is what are the tests that could be very significant to diagnosis and treatment of a patient that are not being done enough?
Mm-hmm. When we think about the future really of healthcare, I guess really two questions. One, on a kind of a global level, what are the three things that we might look forward to in the next 10 years? I know Gates Foundation is working on these tests for these, you know, to be able to diagnose malaria and other diseases. But we worry about how do we diagnose Alzheimer's. And then I guess the final thing would be, as a CEO of LabCorp, what is it that you want us to think 10 years from now we would want to remember about LabCorp?
I think that, you know, if we think about three trends of what's going to change in healthcare in the next 10 years, first of all, as I said, greater patient engagement. There's going to be more and more responsibility on the patient to take charge of the patient's health. The second thing is what I will call the globalization of healthcare. And what I mean by that is in the developing world, there are some very basic diseases like malaria, like bacterial meningitis that are still widespread. They still have terrible consequences, and a lot of people are sickened or die as a result.
Yeah. Well, thank you for the work you're doing. We certainly can't take care of patients and do what we do without the benefits of laboratory medicine and science. And we're grateful that you took time with us today to share your work.
Well, we depend on people like you for our business, and we greatly appreciate your trust, and it's been great being with you.
Well, we appreciate it, and I think there's a passion about what you do, and it's behind the scenes, but equally vital to a successful outcome. So thank you. I hope maybe in the future when new tests come out, we can hear about them and understand them better.
Great. Thank you.
We've been talking with David King, Chief Executive Officer and President of LabCorp, about science and laboratory medicine. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the house call segment of our show today, Ab and I will spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And if you as a listener have a question you'd like for us to address on an upcoming show, you can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu, or you can email us on our app your questions. We'd love to hear from you. We'd like to ask our executive producer, Erica Lloyd, to read us our very first house call today about a listener concerned about memory and their mother.
I went to visit my mother, and I noticed she seemed more forgetful than usual, and this is quite subtle. When I asked the doctor, he said he hadn't seen anything different in her behavior. A family friend said I should get formal testing done with a memory specialist or get her current doctor to do more advanced testing. What are your thoughts?
Well, clearly you're concerned about this, and you know your mother better than most people probably. And so I think if you're concerned about it, you definitely should bring her in. Sometimes that change, sometimes that can be a sign of early, what we call cognitive impairment, or where your person's brain is not working quite as well as it was, sort of an early dementia type picture. Or it could be something like depression that could be treated with medication and might help her, think and sort of be seen back to usual.
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean Alzheimer's, which is, I guess, that word is that the modern cancer word we don't like to talk about. It could be if they have longstanding high blood pressure. It could be, just as you said, Christy, this dementia from the vascular condition, which doesn't mean that's going to necessarily get worse. But I like your family friend there. I think their recommendations are spot on, and recommend that you do get a more formal testing, because you know what? A lot of people can really cover up very easily when they're with their doctor and say, I don't remember that. Who remembers that kind of stuff? But formal testing would uncover it and might be elucidating for you, your mother, and your family doctor all together, and spurn some interesting and probably difficult and important conversations.
You're doing the right thing by pursuing this.
Thank you so much. Erica, what's our very next house call?
It seems like so many of my parents' friends are suffering from hip fractures. They stumble or trip a lot, it seems. Is this just a natural part of getting older? What can I do to prevent this from happening to me?
Great question, and I wish it were just a part of getting older. I think I stumble and trip way too much at my age, and sometimes I think it's just because we're going too fast. We're trying to do too many things too fast, but it is a significant problem for the elderly in terms of hip fractures, and we do see a lot of this.
A hip fracture is a really big deal. So it is something that you want to prevent, and the biggest thing is to prevent yourself from falling. And so there are things you can do to keep your body fit, to keep your muscles toned, to do strengthening exercises or physical therapy, just to keep sort of working on your balance and your strength, especially in your core muscles over time.
Yeah, Christy and I think have talked a couple times recently about the physical fitness as you get older, about the muscle strength, but there's also this balance element, which is a third element that's really important, because balance is sometimes where we lose and we trip. But there's also the common sense things, and you just mentioned it when you started, Christy, about reducing fall risk, things like having shoes that aren't slippery.
Yes, about having rails that you use when you're going up and down stairs.
About when you've got an animal, a pet, about being very, very careful, because they can pull you and you can trip over the leash, and even the carpets that are slipping. We need to avoid all of those things.
Making sure you have something to hold on to when you get in and out of the shower. It's a place that can be really slippery in the bathtub.
Right. We strongly recommend a fall assessment be done in a house for a lot of people, because there's lots of things that we wouldn't think about. But someone who does these types of risk assessments, and we'll actually ask our health librarians at the UNC library to put some information about maybe tools that people can do to really look more broadly in their environment for ways to reduce their falls risk and reduce the risk of fractures.
You also want to think about trying to prevent osteoporosis if you can. by avoiding medications that can make your bones decline, by taking vitamin D, by doing weight-bearing exercise over time to try to reduce your chance of getting those fragile bones.
Including not smoking as one gets older, in addition, because it does increase your osteoporosis risk.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you so much for that important question, and we really do wish you and anyone else who's experienced that the best in healing. Erica, what's our very next house call?
I was bitten by a dog several weeks ago and thought it healed until my ring finger started to swell. I went to see the doctor and he said I had an infection in my bone, for which I was taken and admitted for intravenous antibiotics. Why are dog bites so serious? And can I get rabies even if the dog was vaccinated?
I'm pretty sure you wouldn't get rabies if the dog was vaccinated. I'm interested in Adam's take on that. But dog bites do tend to get infected. I think there's just a lot of bacteria in the dog's mouth, and they just get in there. It's kind of in a rough, usually the cut where they bite is rough, and bacteria can get in there. In this case, it got into your bone, something called osteomyelitis.
Yeah, you know, the type of organisms that gets into these bites is frequently different types, but one of them is these what's called anaerobic, these bacteria that don't live well in oxygen poor areas. And in the hands, particularly these small spaces, those bacteria can multiply because there's not a lot of room to expand and the blood flow goes down. In addition, there's an organism called Pastorella, which you see in dog and cat bites, and there's nothing pasture-like about it in terms of its infection potential. So a lot of times we'll put people on antibiotics to prevent these things after you've had a dog bite. So if you get a dog bite, particularly in your hands, even on your extremities, yeah, I'd get in to see your doctor and talk with your doctor about it, because we probably could prevent this sort of thing from happening.
Think about it, getting a tetanus shot, which is often indicated in these cases. And just remember, if you have an injury to your hand, especially one that could get infected, I mean, that's really not something you want to play around with too much, because it's a closed space. You need your hand. And so if you can prevent it from getting infected or getting a more serious injury, it's worth that trip to the doctor, even if it's just them telling you you're going to be okay.
Good luck. We hope that you do really well. Let's talk with our very last house call, Erica.
I'm a longtime patient of UNC Family Medicine. I noticed a new web design, and it's really helpful for patients as well as healthcare providers. I saw your press release showing that you are the number 2 ranked program. Congratulations and keep up the good work.
Yay, that's so nice. Thank you.
Go team, go team. You know, Christy, this is really amazing. This is the number 2 ranked program in the United States. And I tell this to people sometimes, and sometimes they say, well, why aren't you number 1? And we're like, we are the highest ranked program in all of this region, and one of the few that's really consistently right there. This is an outstanding achievement. It has nothing to do with Christy and I, but everything to, well, Christy, because you're a residency director. We have great residents. We've got great leadership. We really strive in this healthcare system to be innovative and to do the right things. Are we perfect? Absolutely not, but it is something to celebrate.
We are certainly putting our best foot forward, and we're happy for this, that we've been the second-ranked program for many years now. We're trying to be number 1, but that University of Washington has been consistently doing really well.
Well, we'll be number 1 in about 2/3 of the country. But what this really means
states.
Is that also we want to hear from patients. We want to figure out how we can get better and continue to improve. And I think that's the goal here, is to say that we want to be a place where people are comfortable coming. We're about to embark on a $3 million transformation of our clinical space down in the Family Medicine Center to make it more patient-friendly, so that you as patients can see your doctor when you want to see them and at the times that are convenient for you, and to really make sports medicine, the entire experience of coming to the doctor, even better.
It is exciting. We're really working to capitalize on team-based care and on those personal relationships with your doctor. So we're excited about that endeavor and proud to be a part of a department where we really are working towards being part of the solution for healthcare.
So thank you for noticing that. And thank you to all of our listeners who sent in really interesting house call questions and comments today. And we want to thank our guests for being with us today, David King, CEO of LabCorp. And we also want to thank all of you for listening today. And you can send any comments to us at yourhealth@unc.edu.
We want to be sure to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship as well. And we hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. We'll look forward to talking with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.